Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. Diligent listeners among you will know that last week the Monocle team was dispatched to Milan for this year's Salone del Mobile Design Fair and the many other goings-on during Milan Design Week. We broadcast live from the design behemoth for the whole week, interviewing some of the leading lights in the industry. While perusing the many installations, we also spoke to various artists and designers about how their industries collide and overlap so often. And so, on today's programme, we're going to look at the way designers work with artists through the lens of a couple of projects presented at last week's fair, from some Luna-inspired furniture created by American artist Matthew Day Jackson to a living plant installation for fashion brand Jill Sander by the Australian artist Linda Tegg. Plus, we'll flip the discussion and speak to the filmmaker Gary Huswit about his fascinating films about design. That's all ahead on the Monocle Culture Show. We start in the north of Milan, where in a colourful building situated around a small leafy courtyard, a brand new collaboration between Finnish furniture manufacturers Made by Choice and the American artist Matthew Day Jackson was being presented, called Kolo. Matthew Day Jackson has long been interested in the moon, and that's the subject of this line of tables and chairs. The flat-pack tables have an image of the far side of the moon imprinted into their formica tops. And formica is a material that Jackson has a long relationship with and was key to this project. In Milan, these bright creations were on display alongside a series of Jackson's paintings of flowers in vases that he's known for, a sort of juxtaposition between the inhabited and the uninhabitable. Matthew Day Jackson tells Monocle's Holly Fisher about the series of happy coincidences that took him from artist to designer.
I'm doing a show in Finland in May at the Sirlakius Museum in Mantavipola. And I went on a site visit, and at dinner I was being taught about Finnish history and its importance in the area and how it relates to this Finnish Civil War and a lot. And there were all these connections to the work that were kind of uncanny at that point. And then they started talking about, like, well, what's nearby? And what was nearby, there was this town called Kolho. And I was like, well, that's a kind of beautiful name. Like, what does that mean? And it's like, well, Kolho is like vacant or empty or creepy. Or they gave me all these sort of descriptions. It was funny. We ended up learning more about the place. I Googled it, and this the first thing that popped up was Formica Ikioi, and I've been making artwork using Formica, not in terms of its color or durability or anything, but really in terms of its materiality and what it means, you know, in relationship to my family home, a burgeoning middle class after World War II, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, holy crap, there's a Formica factory really close to the museum. So I immediately was like, oh, I have to see if they can make something. So we tried to make a tour, didn't work. Fast forward, 4 weeks later, I was back in Finland, but seeing a sculpture in Sarvisalo that I had made. That's a permanent artwork. It's my only permanent artwork with the Zabludovitz collection there. And knowing coming back that I would go on a tour of the factory, of the Formica factory. And so I go to Sarvisalo, I get out of the car, and I join the group that's getting a tour of the collection there. And I happen into this guy named Nicholas Alstrom, and he was like, hey, what's your name? I'm like, I'm Matt. And what's your name? Nicholas. What do you do? I make furniture. And I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, I'm an artist. I make furniture from time to time because sculptors do that. And he's like, oh, we should make furniture together. And I was like, it just so happens that I'm going on a tour of the Formica factory. And I want to see if they can make the far side of the moon embossed into the surface of Formica. And he's like, oh, that'd be really cool. And I was like, I know. What if it was like on a bent ply chair? That would be like really Finnish, very cool. And we joked and it was fun. Fast forward, go to the factory, go on a tour. I try to talk the factory manager into doing this thing, and he says, no, can't do it. So you have to talk to somebody else. I'm like, who do I talk to? And this is like me kind of pestering him because I was like, no, like I really need to try to make the far side of the moon in Formica. And and ended up coming to this man named Phil Wise. Phil Wise heard my story, and he's like, that's really interesting. A lot of serendipitous connections. Fascinating. I think our next call should be with our design team at the plate-making facility in France. And I was like, what, really? Because normally those calls are like, no, you're crazy. Shut up. But it didn't. And so that led to months of plate development to get to this point here. The tables and chairs are a loose meditation on exploration and the relationship between sort of two polarities of our humanity, which is chaos and reason, Apollo and Dionysus, the wiggly form and the rectilinear form, and hopefully in making like a beautiful dining sort of theater.
I just love that you've made a piece of furniture out of a place that's so uninhabitable as something that is going to be so lived on and around, like the kitchen table is such a hub of the home. Was that something that was crossing your mind when you were making this?
Yeah, I've made lunar surface and carpet, drywall, formica, a lot of formica lunar surfaces. And I think that it was about, like, you know, the way that we explore our natural environment, which includes the moon and outer space, and now Voyager, as it's like going outside of our solar system. That's our natural environment. But the problem with how we explore it is that we try to capture it, to name it, to classify, to cut it up into sections of, like, I own this part, you own that part. And I think that, like, I've always been interested in how these materials, you know, express domesticity and express that, like, the closest, most intimate space in which we do really, like, express ourselves. So, yeah, I guess I always thought about that. There is actually a song that does, like, bring a lot of the ideas about our relationship to our natural environment and how we relate to that, and it's like it's a John Prine song. Do you know who John Prine is? It's like, Father, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lays. I'm sorry, my son, well, you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's Coltrane's come and drug it away. Sorry, I'm nervous. It probably is a little bit out of tune, but that's, like, you know, in a nutshell, it's like something to hold or to take with, irregardless of how it might feel. And so, you know, it's, I think that a lot of, like, the floral pieces are absolutely about that, you know, about the to take, to classify, to jam together, or maybe even to force something to blossom outside of its actual, you know, sort of seasonal, the season in which it would blossom. And so I think there are definitely connections in all that, what you're saying.
What is it about formica that you have always loved so much, and why have you always used it in your work?
You know, I think that every meal that I had prepared by my mother, you know, it was on that surface. And so it talks about, like, how our, like, we have a relationship to, not everybody, but a lot of people have a relationship to this material, and it comes to very particular places in our experience on Earth, with our family, in our home, or at a friend's house, or whatever. And that's really, really interesting. But at the same time, because we could bleed on it, spill wine, hot. I've actually spilled molten lead on formica and then just, like, knocked it off, and there was no mark. You know, and that, going back to what I was saying about, you know, our exploration of our natural environment doesn't really have anything to do with the environment, but rather to constantly seeking proof that we exist. Like, I was saying it earlier, it's like almost like searching for your glasses in the blackness of the night. You know, it's like feeling around, and then we're like, oh, there I am. But I like how the moon too has, like, weirdly resisted our experience. And this particular image, which is taken from scale of 80 microns to, like, 40 plus thousand feet. That's the scale of why we chose these. That actually, the green table is the most exemplary of that full sheet. But we went there, but we didn't go there. And this surface that resists us, that surface, which it constantly keeps its back to us like a beaten dog, same.
Now to one of the many installations that take over Milan as part of Design Week. The ever-growing manifesto of Salone is encapsulated a few steps away from the busy Brera district, where fashion giant Jill Sander collaborated with Australian artist Linda Tegg on Adjacent Field, a living installation of plants set inside the brand's Milanese headquarters. This is a vivid demonstration of a major brand empowering emerging artists and designers. Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles, caught up with Jill Sander's creative directors, Luke and Lucy Meyer, and the artist, Linda Tegg. First is Lucy.
Nature kind of plays a big role in our work. Like, we're always really inspired by it, and we always kind of have a link to it. So we really wanted to bring nature into our space and our environment and just have it close by. Then we just kind of started looking around, and then obviously we came across Linda's work, and it kind of just clicked right away, and it was actually very straightforward. It's like, okay, she's the one, let's ask her. She was down immediately, and yeah.
Yeah, she was kind of the top of the list.
Yeah.
And I guess we were lucky she was available and willing and...
reactive.
And local,
yeah.
Kind of.
Well, there was this moment of serendipity, because I was coming through Milan just at the
randomly,
time that you...
Yeah.
Meant to happen, yeah. Exactly.
And, you know, despite how it maybe look when someone photographs it, there's definitely Milan in here, literally, because you've brought in plants and nature from kind of industrial parts outside the city. How did you want this to reflect Milan?
Well, we wanted to not make it feel artificial in a way, like it had to feel authentic, and that you could actually imagine these plants growing through the floors here. So it had to be flowers that actually grow here. So it was kind of, it wasn't about creating an exotic garden. It was really like bringing the nature in here that would actually grow here.
And I think there's a certain, maybe a perspective about consciousness that we wanted to kind of bring in as well, because I think it's interesting that, you know, these plants are presented this way here, which is a bit more precious and a bit more important than they are, you know, when you encounter them outside. So with people knowing that these are actually from, you know, the sidewalks or around the buildings that they kind of inhabit all the time, it's quite interesting to, you know, that, yeah, to elevate them, but then also that maybe people's perspective about them will change, and they'll notice them a little bit more.
And Milan itself as a city, how are you guys finding it? Salone del Mobile is obviously such a huge event.
Yeah.
You come in here and it's a very calm and relaxed vibe, and I'm guessing a reflection of your values and your attitude to design. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with the city?
We've been here now, I guess, a little bit over 2 years. We've been coming back and forth. We visited Milan for years before. And our world here is actually quite compact, because we live close to the studio and we're working a lot. And I think usually when we have extended periods of time off from work, we kind of tend to get out of town a little bit. But I think the city is quite a nice scale, actually. It's not overwhelmingly crowded and hectic and really busy, which I actually kind of like now. It kind of lets you calm your mind a little bit and focus. And the people are very welcoming, and they're very friendly people. So I think the attitude is very nice. It's very pleasant here. But it definitely feels like it's not like this massive, weighty city. So, you know, I think it's quite nice to live here, actually.
And to work, I mean, you know, I'm from London. We're dealing with Brexit at the moment. Mm-hmm. The creative community is worried. Architects, designers, fashion designers, they're thinking about where else could we go. Obviously, like, Paris is established for fashion. Brands, fashion designers are moving to places like Zurich. They are moving to smaller cities around Europe. I'd love to hear your thoughts on being fashion designers in Milan.
I think the attitude is, like, of the people who work in fashion is very positive. They like to try. They don't like to say, no, it's impossible. Like, they try to actually make things work. And there's, like, kind of a dreaming attitude. So I think it's really, and they're very proud of what they do. So I think they like to try and make it happen and then be, like, extra proud. So I think it's quite good for a designer. It's quite satisfying, I think, because also there's so much craft around, and like, people really value their work, and so I think, yeah, it's quite positive, recommendable.
And just going back to the installation, you know, it's something that lives and breathes. It's nature inside your building, from what I understand. You're planning to keep it here. Mm-hmm. You're obviously big fans. Can you tell us about your relationship with this installation and what you plan to do with it?
we want to live with it. We want to have it around us when we work, when we eat here, when we, you know, when you need a moment to think. Like, it's nice to just think, okay, I'm going to go sit in the garden. And it's just like a positive energy, I feel like. And we're looking forward to seeing it change and evolve and, you know, become part of our life and evolve like us. So we'll see. It's like filled with surprises. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but will be nice to see.
And Linda, perhaps can we get a bit of a forecast? You know, we were at day one of the Venice Pavilion and there was already butterflies and probably worms and things. You know, what will this become?
Yeah, it's interesting to see that already when you sort of bring forward one life form like these plants, others are following. So we have a lot of insects around of all, and like some I've never encountered before. So that's interesting and exciting. I think that a lot of the plants that we see here that are really quite green right now, they might toward the end of the summer start to brown off and other things will come forward. Winter will feel like winter. And just looking into some of these areas now, I see all these sprouts coming up and I have no idea what they are yet. And so there could be, anything could come up through here, which is so exciting to me.
Hopefully something that catches all the mosquitoes in here in the summer.
Yeah.
Because Milan has mosquitoes that are fierce.
Maybe a frog.
Maybe a frog.
To end today's programme, we're going to revisit an interview from 2015 when Robert Bound spoke to the filmmaker Gary Huswit about the way we talk about design on screen. Gary's made wonderful films about design, including Helvetica, about the typeface of the same name, Objectified, about industrial design, the things we use, and Urbanized, about how architects and city planners build cities. Gary's films are much loved for their clarity in dealing with big ideas, and they're great speakers, of course. There's no voiceovers, just answers to Huswit's questions, but we don't hear those questions, so what does he ask? How does he demystify design and make it tell larger truths about how we all look at the world?
Helvetica emerges in that period, in 1957, where there's felt to be a need for rational typefaces, which can be applied to all kinds of contemporary information, whether it's sign systems or corporate identity, and present those visual expressions of the modern world to the public in an intelligible, legible way.
When I started Helvetica, one of the reasons that I wanted to make the film was I was kind of shocked that there was such a lack of interviews with these designers, of video interviews. It's interesting that in the past, you know, 10 years since I started working on that film, there is much more design kind of related documentary stuff, small clips and feature-length documentaries. But, you know, 2005, there was nothing. I kind of was like, why aren't people doing this? Why aren't the kind of the design institutions and, you know, Cooper Hewitt and these other museums and other people, why aren't they kind of compiling this stuff? I think it's important to kind of see these designers at work and get an idea of their process. And you can do that in kind of such an interesting way in video, in a way that you can't do in just, you know, looking at pictures of their work or whatever.
Who struck you as being someone that could be a fantastic filmmaker, I wonder? Who after that had happened or before that had happened, did you get an inkling of people that you thought, wow, you've got a whole other area of expertise you could plow into, certain personalities you spoke to?
Well, I mean, it's almost a universal, and it's something that I realized about myself as I went through the process of doing all these interviews and making the films, is that same kind of impulse to just ask why and just question the way things are and try to kind of do things differently is very, very similar to from documentary filmmakers and designers. So in a sense, I think I'm probably like a closet designer that didn't just went into other things. But it's the same impulse. It's the reason I made Helvetica was I just really wanted to watch a movie about type and graphic design, and it didn't exist, and it really made me mad that, that I couldn't get one. So then I just, after about, you know, 6 months of being angry, I just said, okay, well, I've just got to go do it.
Yeah.
But I think that same impulse is a real key to design thinking as well.
Presumably the curiosity is why does an object not exist to serve the purpose which I need served?
Yeah.
And that's a very, and also in terms of interviewing people, I presume, it's a skill that you had, you learnt, you but it's something where sometimes you feel interviewers want to tell someone that they admire how much they know about them rather than asking them simple questions.
I hope what came across and when I was meeting these people and interviewing them was that I was genuinely curious about this stuff. I wasn't being sent out by some news crew to, you know, just get a soundbite from them. I mean, I had flown across the across the world and, you know, on my own money, and I just really wanted to learn about what they do and why and just dig into their process. So yeah, that's something that you know continuously drove me, was I wanted to know more. In a strange way, it's like with each of these films, I kind of was a crash course in that discipline, it's graphic design or, you know, industrial design or urban design. And it's sort of a personal kind of exploration for me. And the kind of output of that exploration is the film. For me, it's about the exploration and the conversations. And then the film kind of is the thing that comes out of
that. Yeah. You've gone on a journey and you know there's more to it, but this is the stuff that you can saleably give to other people, presumably, I guess.
Exactly.
The design is part of that need to rebuild, to reconstruct, to make things more open, make them run more smoothly, be more democratic. There was this real sense of social responsibility among designers.
Did you ever feel that you were being, I mean, now reading back and going through the extra 97% of the transcripts that didn't make it into the films, do you feel that you were being sold to, or you were being sold a dream by one particular person, or do you see now the fuller context?
I think I definitely see the fuller context. I mean, the conversations were so wide-ranging at the time, mostly because I don't prepare questions when I go into the interviews. I think that's one thing that's probably different from maybe other filmmakers.
we'll let the listeners decide.
Well, I just the idea of having a prepared question and reading it off to the person, it just kills any kind of natural flow of the conversation. And that's my biggest goal, is to try to get the other person to forget that they're being interviewed, to forget that there's a camera there and microphones. So I try not to like stop in the middle of the conversation and look down and say,
yeah,
so what did you know, and read off some pre-done, like word for word question.
And I think one of the appeals, and this will be one of the appeals even more so of the book that we're talking about as opposed to the films perhaps, is that thing where people find that their lives are being talked about, where the accidental or the actual engineering of large aspects of people's lives are being talked about by some of the people that have helped to engineer parts of their lives, and they never really realized it. And truths are unfolded in front of people's eyes. That's how I felt watching these films.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing thing that these people do. It's an amazing talent to have as an interviewer as well. Were you struck afresh when reading the transcripts and putting this book together about the larger truths told by small aspects of people's lives?
Sure. I mean, the one thing that I really think I realize is that the interviews in their entirety are much more interesting than the films.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, that's quite an amazing testament to those interviews.
I mean, at least to me they are, because, again, they're not so to the point. And I like hearing Mark Newson talk about surfing and surf culture and how that affected his design process and his aesthetic. And there's so many times where we're just talking about anything. And, you know, we've kind of included a lot of those sort of off-camera conversations in the book as well. So for me, it's a personal experience. I mean, I was there. And so for me, it's there's some nostalgia. I mean, when I go back and read the Massimo Vignelli interview, for instance, or...
And you obviously became... You were before, or you certainly became friends with him?
After, yeah.
Right,
Since Helvetica, but... So, like, I'm kind of really, you know, getting kind of transported back to these places, or Bill Moggridge, or you know, a few of the other... You know, Oscar Niemeyer, some of the other people in the films who've passed away since then. You know, I'm struck by how little I knew about design and also about interviewing, going back and reading. And also I saw, when you lay it all out, I kind of see my lazy habits or kind of routines that I fall into, in terms of, like, there's one question I think I pretty much ask every single person in the book.
You better tell us what that is.
Yeah.
You can let a little bit of daylight in upon the magic of your book.
I usually save it for the end, and I always ask them, if you were going to walk into a theater and sit down and watch a film about typography and the, you know, curtain opened and the lights went down, like, what would you want somebody up there to say that we haven't talked about yet? And that usually gets some pretty good responses.
And that brings us to the end of today's Monocle Culture Show, produced by Holly Fisher. If you want to hear any more of our coverage from Milan Design Week, then you can listen back to last week's special editions of both The Briefing and Midori House. And don't forget to download tomorrow's episode of Monocle on Design. Rob will be back at the same time next week to bring you next week's Culture Show. But for now, thanks for tuning in.